This is tape number 3, side 1 of the ongoing oral history interview with Emeritus Professor of Scandinavian Studies, Niels Ingwersen, on November 1st, 2006. When we left off yesterday, we were just starting to talk about the department in the 1970s, your colleagues, your activities in the department leading up to your period as chair later in the 70s. So why don't we begin with the 70s?
Sure. I got tenure, and my senior colleagues informed me that I probably should be the next chair, which then was a 3-year period.
Mm-hmm.
I was not exactly happy about that because I wanted to write a book. And I know that the chairmanship takes a lot of time, especially the first time around, since you don't know the ropes. Luckily, I was rescued by the grant I got from Denmark. So I could postpone my tenure as chair for 3 years. Because my colleague, who got tenure the same year, Kim Nilsson, the linguist, became chair instead. And here I have to add a comment. Kim Nilsson has always since maintained that the fact he became chair right after getting tenure proved to be detrimental to his scholarship. He was too busy being chair and therefore not that productive as a scholar. And he says it has haunted him ever since. So maybe it's wise to give newly tenured people a period of research before they ask to be chairs.
Huh. Interesting. Do you think he's right?
Yeah, up to a point I think he's right, because he became much less productive. And I think that, well, the chairmanship is a necessary institution. There's no doubt about it. And I think that every faculty member who is a fairly good administrator should try it. Because you don't really know how the university works until you're the chair. Until you deal with deans quite often and go to the dean's meetings and whatnot. I learned an awful lot during my first year as chair.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to be chair, but it's also a task, because at least in our department, the chair is the office boy, office girl, who has to care all those chores that the others shouldn't do. So there's an awful lot of chores, an awful lot of little things that the chair has to take care of. And at that time, in small departments, we all taught 3 courses per semester. That was common. And that wasn't changed until Dan Crawford became dean in the 80s, I think.
So you're working quite hard for a long time.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. 3 and 3 was the rule. And in small departments, the big departments like English and History, was 2 and 2.
So there was a
discrepancy there, which small departments were not too happy about that, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And to that I should add that we always felt in Scandinavian Studies that we were understaffed. We needed one more FTE, which we quite hadn't got, but the situation is better now. So, and the chair supposedly can take one course off, teach one course less per semester. The trouble is that we can't quite do that if we want to have a viable department.
Oh.
So our chairs have hardly ever used that option. They always taught a full load. So it can be taxing to the chair.
And that was true for small departments,
yes,
across the college?
Absolutely.
Interesting.
So, when my colleague, Dick Ringler, who was in English, then he moved to Scandinavian Studies half-time, became chair after Harald Ness in the 60s. He told his English chair, well, I'm going to be chair of Scandinavian Studies now, but the small department will be easy. And his chair laughed scornfully. Just you wait, he said. And Dick Ringler admits that it's a big job to be chairs, even if the department is small. Uh-huh. Because there's so many negotiations about economy, deans, associate deans, and students also go to the chair, you know, if there's an issue and things like that. So often you read an awful lot of memos. And I remember when I was chair, first time around, I felt sort of 10 o'clock at night, well, I've done my job now. I'd written my memos, but I hadn't prepared for my classes. So now and then classes suffer because you're busy being administrator, and now and then research does suffer. And more earlier than now. So I can see the grounds for Kim Nielsen's complaint. I can. Also, one thing that happens when you're chair is that now and then there is a exercise orders. It probably comes from the capital. We all have to cut, you know, 1-3%. And then
really?
The department says, yes, have to prepare a document, self-evaluate, prepare a document, how will you do these 1-3% cuts? And of course you relegate, but somebody has to write that document. And it really is the chair that, in the last analysis, will have to do that. And Kim had one of these monster reports, as we call them. So there are lots of duties. And then, you know, we don't come to this this racket to be administrators. We come because we want to teach and write, do research. There's that tension too.
Mm-hmm. Before we leave the early 70s, you had made one reference to tenure before,
mm-hmm.
but I take it from what you said earlier that obtaining tenure for you was not difficult.
No, in those days you needed, I think, 5 articles that were refereed and showed new directions. Now a book is required. So it's tougher now. You also now have one more year. Now it's 6 years tenure. Then it was 5 years. But it was easier in my time to get tenure.
And you were not worried, as I recall.
No. Well, you are nervous, but not really. No. Mm-hmm. No.
So you got tenure in 1970?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. And then there was, I stayed in Denmark, and then I came back and became chair. And all young chairs make mistakes and have to be called on the carpet by deans. That's their job. We had a dean called Remus in those days, and I really appreciate his advice. He was a very helpful associate dean. But at that time, then, I started writing our book on the Danish author Martin Hansen, and I think it's fair to say that's our best book. The next one was easier, but it wasn't quite that exciting to write. This one was very exciting to write.
Mm-hmm.
So I was chair, I taught my 3 courses per semester, and we tried to write a book. So these were very busy times.
When you were working on your book,
yeah,
while you were chair?
Yeah. I somehow couldn't postpone that task any longer. I was under contract, so I had a deadline, which I had to push a couple of times.
And just talk a little bit about the book and the subject.
Well, the author is Martin A. Hansen, who grew up in the countryside. And he was discovered he was a bright boy, so he was sent to school, and he became a school teacher in the 1930s during the Depression. He started writing collective novels, or in the Marxist mode, the 30s, and then the Second World War broke out. And he felt deeply ashamed that Denmark had not, the Danish soldiers had not fought for more than a few hours against the Germans. He was a patriot. And also at that point he turned away from Marxism and became interested more in sort of metaphysical matters. He wrote two books during the war that are based upon folklore, and they're allegorical. They're about the past, but they're really about the present, and they're about the Second World War. Hansen was then known as a very good and actually very funny writer, And one day some people from resistance knocked on his door and said, we need your help. We want you to write in the underground press. The situation was that there were a number of Danish collaborators in uniform in his local side, people. And they were considered traitors. And there were, of course, a number of Danish Nazis and a very small Nazi party that never had any real importance. The worst kind, however, were the informers. Those in civilian clothes who realized that the neighbors were in the resistance, and they then reported to the Hitler side, the Gestapo, they told on their countrymen. They were the worst. And when the resistance found out that this person was an informer, they were shot, executed on the spot. We couldn't wait for the peace, you know, and the court case and whatnot. And it's very difficult for Danes to do that. We haven't had any war since 1864.
Right.
People are basically pacifists. They believe that we shall not kill and so on. So it's a very difficult ethical situation. But the point was that it's necessary, because these people are traitors, and if they're not killed, then other good Danes will be killed. Mm-hmm. These people from the resistance wanted Hansen to write articles in the underground press to convince young Danes that these informers must be executed on the spot. And he agreed. So he wrote a number of articles that are very, very eloquent. I read them all. And that people could detect it was Hansen who was the author, because he was a fine stylist. So the Nazis realized this must be Hansen who's behind these articles, so he had to flee to Sweden, where he spent the rest of the war, the occupation. Then he came back and discovered that his articles really had an impact, that young people had joined the resistance because he wrote those articles and had killed informants. So the might of the pen was certainly brought home. But he also felt a sense of guilt. You know, this is what artists do. Artists can be so destructive. And he wrote some very enticing works about that, and that's what he basically wrote about. But then you had a Second World War again. He died young because he had, as a school teacher, he was busy, but he also wanted to write. So he used too much booze, too many cigarettes, too many amphetamines, so he ruined his health. So he died when he was 40, his 40s.
Oh my God.
In 55, I think. And he stopped writing fiction because artists are liars. That's one famous book called The Liar, a very good book, about a man who doesn't write, but he lies, he manipulates others, he dupes others, and so on. That's what artists do. He felt that to be an artist is always the blemish. It's destructive to others. So he wrote historical treatises instead. Then he was in the hospital. It was clear he was dying. And then suddenly he got inspired again to write stories and wrote sketches down. And his last sketch is very interesting. He tells that he and his wife went to Norway for a summer vacation and enjoyed being up in the mountains, but he couldn't go to bed at night because he felt that out through the forest would come some people to see him. So a strange anticipation, so he couldn't sleep. So he sat up in these light Norwegian nights. And suddenly, one day, two people came out of the forest and walked across the meadow towards the house and asked to come in. And they said, we come here to ask you whether you still meant what you wrote during those years. And he says, this author, who doesn't call himself Hans Hansen, well, you know, it's different times now. Things have changed. It's hard to remember. Well, they say, it's very important, you know, because, you see, he shot me, and then I got shot. So we want to know what you really meant, what you said, because we cannot rest in peace unless we know. And he says, well, you know, it's different times now, it's peace now, it was so different. Well, you're sorry you came out, so at least you can walk us all to the forest. And the story ended there, and he died a few days later. So it's a haunting authorship. So it was interesting to write, and it was very taxing to write. And, he split chapters between us and then sort of read each other's chapters. And it took 2.5 years to write that book.
A very important book.
Oh, yeah.
Were you happy with the
product? Yes, we were very happy with it. I'm glad we got the deadlines extended because it improved the book immensely.
Was it published in Danish as well as English?
No. The Danish market is too small. The books are so expensive in Denmark. And there's a lot of scholarship already, so they didn't need another one, so to speak. But it's known in Denmark. People have referred to it and so on. So but Danes often, they have to read criticism in other languages because the market is too small. So that was the most exciting thing during our first challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What major administrative issues surfaced during?
Well, there was always this threat of budget cuts, and as a chair, you have to. Oh, right, endless memos to the dean. Can we have another TA in Norwegian? I think we need to open another section where students will ask for it. Can we do that? You know, small matters, in a sense, petty matters, but necessary matters.
Is David Cronin dean at this point?
David Cronin is dean at this point, yes. However, we more or less dealt with the associate dean, Doremus, whom I mentioned, who was a very, very pleasant person to work with.
Okay.
Cronin I didn't know that well until later.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Then I stepped down as chair, and got involved ever so slightly with the folklore, and also I was at this point. I stepped down as chair. And then I felt that Denmark was failing. And I really should go back and get reacquainted with my own culture.
So this was the late 70s?
That's 78. And I talked to an acquaintance at the University of Aarhus, another university, provincial university, and he was very keen on coming to America. So we made a swap. Also in terms of houses. He lived here and I lived in his house and over there.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, talk, if you would, how did you know your ties to Danish culture and your identity were fading?
Well,
how did you come to that awareness?
At that time, well, again, I'm back every summer. And I can feel I don't know the new slang. I don't know the actors on stage. And when I saw Danish movies, I had no idea who these people acting were. Also, I found myself, when I read newspapers over here, Danish newspapers, reading less and less because I didn't know the politicians. So there was no doubt about the fact that I was being kind of less sensitive to Danish issues. Also, if I had been asked to vote in Denmark, I wouldn't quite know which party to vote for. So in various ways, all these small signs that told me that now, entering my 40s, I was losing touch somewhat, which I hadn't felt before.
Did you still feel as much a Dane?
Yeah, but I think I did so because my father was still there, my brother was there, my friends were there. So I started at that point thinking about becoming an American citizen, no,
uh-huh.
Not at all. So it's more so to refresh myself, I want to go to Denmark.
Uh-huh.
It's not to get a job, uh-huh. Just to spend a year there. And also I was told when I got back, well, now you're 40, so there's no way anybody will hire you here. They couldn't say that legally, of course, but that was the tenor. And I'm sure they met. It was too late if I wanted to get back. So we went back as a guest, but not as somebody who would be hired by a Danish university.
You were still carrying a Danish passport
oh, yeah.
at this time?
Oh yeah.
And what was your status here in the United States?
Green card.
Green card.
Yeah. which gives you right to do everything except what you can pay taxes and whatnot, but you can't do it.
How good of it.
Yeah, sure.
So how long were you in Denmark this time?
That was another year or so, nearly a year, at the University of Aarhus, which was, that was the tail end of the Marxist period. And I taught two classes, freshmen, who were not allowed to see me the first week because they had been so told by last year's freshmen how to handle these teachers. So there was certain hostility towards the teachers from the part of the students, which I never had felt in America. Well, we got along all right, but it was not the greatest experience. And students had a lot of say in those days, about this equality thing. And they wanted to not study refined, elaborate poetry. No T.S. Eliot or Walter Stevens there, or the Danish correspondence. They wanted something like a People magazine or a Ladies' Home Journal. What every ordinary people would read. We should analyze that. That's relevant. The rest is not.
Oh, relevant.
Yeah. And frankly, that stuff bores me. But we did this for half a year. And then we did. Two Danish weeklies, and they were very easy to analyze because it's simple-minded stuff. And around December, even the students got bored. So then we turned to fine poetry again for the second semester. So we got along.
Was there lots of curiosity on the part of the students that you were from America?
The older students. I had a graduate class of people about 30. They've been through all this and they were tired of it. They were left-wingers, but reasonably so, and they were interested in America and American criticism and whatnot. And some of them actually wanted to come here and study, it never materialized, but they were interested, these three-year-olds. That was a very good class. Had a wonderful time with them. But I also felt that the Danish students' preparation, these freshmen, was not nearly as good as it had been earlier. The students had in Odense, the younger students there were better than these students they had in Odense. About 10 years later. Something's happened to the Danish educational system.
And what was that?
Lower demands. High schools becoming more like American high schools, more democratic, if you like, less demanding. And I know some of my contemporaries who were high school teachers bailed out early to go into retirement because they didn't like this watering down process. In all fields, from math to languages or whatever. So it was an interesting year, and I did get in touch with Denmark again. I mean, when you listen to what people gripe about every day, you know the issues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I hadn't realized you had a brother.
Yeah.
Older, younger?
6 years younger.
Huh?
Who, he went to elementary school too, and he got some very bad teachers. He was left-handed, and in those tough old days, he was forced to write with his right hand.
Yeah.
And it created tremendous problems, stuttering and dislike of his teacher. And so he left school after 7 years and became a mechanic.
Oh, I was going to ask if he were an intellectual like you.
He loves reading, but no, because these bad years in. And you had the same teacher in all classes the first 4 or 5 years. So I had a good experience, he had a bad experience. I mean, it's always accidental what happens to you.
Random.
Random it is.
It seems to come up over and over and over again with your colleagues that I talk to.
Sure. Chance plays a tremendous role in life. One can plan to the hilt, and
yes. You
can never plan 100%. Never, never, never.
So, during this year, you have a chance to spend time with your father and brother.
Oh yeah, he lives about an hour away, so his son came out and stayed with us and so on. So we saw a lot of friends and families. That was very pleasant. It was.
And of course, what has always fascinated me about Europe is it's so easy to travel everywhere.
Sure.
And I assume that you did.
Yeah, we have traveled a lot. I mean, we spent the summer in France. After we first met in Norway, we spent the summer in Spain, traveling around there. And then later on, Stacey and I sailed for the Smithsonian No, have lecture will travel. They hired us to do lectures on these books.
Oh, you did that?
Yeah. So we saw Leningrad, it still was Leningrad. Estonia, when it still was Soviet Union. Scotland. And we loved to go to Ireland and travel there. We saw Ireland back in, what was it, 68, the first time, when it still was like America during the Depression. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have seen time in Europe.
Yeah. So you then come back. You were happy to come back.
Yes, I was absolutely happy to come back. Absolutely. We traveled back here with our first cat. The cat came with us over there. Well-traveled cat.
Yeah.
So we came back here, and that's when I had promised in long distance to teach the tales of Hans Christian Andersen, which I did not want to do for the reasons I could mention yesterday.
You did?
Yeah. But I did. And I think I had...
Where was the pressure to teach about Andersen coming
from?
Well,
it was... Small departments need good enrollments. Deans look at enrollments. And another headache as chair is that in those days you got a low enrollment report every semester. Second year Danish, third year Danish, second year Swedish, blah blah blah, have less than these students. We can't have that.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, you never get many students in second or third years in Norwegian. So you have to have other classes that balance it out. I mean, you have to be very pragmatic in small departments. Otherwise, you might be kicked out. That has happened.
That's a brutal side of academia that I've not heard about before.
Well,
for small departments.
I mean, even geography in Michigan got kicked out once.
Really?
Yeah. I evaluated Minnesota some years ago, and they were creating something called the Modern Language Institute to stick Slavics in there and a few other languages. And that means that that's where the tenure faculty goes, and then they retire, and then they're not replaced. Happens all over the country. And small departments are keenly aware of this. So we have to be very protective of ourselves.
So some intellectual inquiry or new directions is fomented by very prosaic concerns mm-hmm. about enrollment mm-hmm. and even departmental survival.
Yeah. There's no doubt about it. I mean, you were called by, when I first came in 65, Les told me that Dean Young, political president, Edwin Young. Always called Scandinavian the little luxury department. I mean, we can afford the luxury to have you here.
Really? I wouldn't call that a ringing endorsement of intellectual inquiry.
No. But they stopped calling us that because we have enrollment now. We have masterpieces, 1 and 2, 100+ students. And now we start with Hans Christian Andersen, and know it's partly that. For very pragmatic reasons, we have to have a course that will draw more students. And also support for grad students, TAs, readers. Because we have grants. We have some pretty good grants for Scandinavian studies, endowments, donuts, but not enough. So we can only, people always ask, can you come and can I work my way through grad school? Now and then you have to say no. You don't have the money. So you have to apply somewhere else. And I always tell students who say, I need money, apply everywhere. I see who gives you the best offer. So we have big classes. You can have readerships. That's just graderships. But there's money there. And now then TAships.
So was it more of an internal decision by the department? Well, let's offer something on Hans Christian Andersen.
Yeah, it was. And then I had to agree, of course.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did you receive that?
Well, I've been chair already, so I knew inside and out, you know, it was necessary. So, of course, I said yes.
This concludes side 1 of tape 3. This is side two of tape three, Niels Ingwersen, November 1st, 2006. So, of course, you said yes. Were you ambivalent, or were you kind of interested?
Well, I was kind of interested. Also, I sat down and read everything Anderson had written, and realized I could pick up so about 60 stories that would be fun to teach, and then I'll leave the rest, the sentimental, pietistic stuff, I would just not teach. So I handpicked the best stories. But I realized I had to do something that I don't like to do. I had to talk about Anderson's life. And I really, that's probably one of my weaknesses as a critic. I'm not interested in biography as such, because I find it to be some kind of peeping Thomas.
Yes.
The private lives don't really interest me. That's why I like folklore and Shakespeare. We don't know anything about their lives. The too much criticism is the first marriage, the second marriage, all this stuff.
Okay.
And frankly, it's the work that interests me, the art, not the person as such. But with Anderson and the Kierkegaard and Isaac Dinesen, you have to talk about their lives. Anderson, because he was a proletarian, the son of a copper and a washerwoman, who lived in poverty in Odense. And he made it to the top. And in those days, you know, there was very little upward mobility.
Yes.
So how and why? So I realized I have to give nearly every day biographical information so people could understand why Anderson put Wilde to the top. That interested me less, but I did that too.
I would think the students here in America would have been very interested.
They are. I mean, that helped because, again, it's a good classroom. I got lots of questions. The first year, because the first year I had 60 students, and that's a group you can handle. But then the class started growing. And then you just stand there and preach, and the TAs have the fun with the small groups. So you rerun yourself. Not completely. You add something new, you know, and you revise. But basically, you are rerunning yourself when you have these big, popular lecture classes. And that can turn a bit drab.
Is it not exhilarating to be
Yes.
speaking to that many students?
It is, because you all teachers, I think, are performers.
Yes.
Yeah.
I am hearing that a lot.
Sure you are. Yes, you are. And that is fun. Especially if you can, the night before, find a new angle. Or something happens that day that you can use in the classroom. And I, since students couldn't, are too shy to ask questions when there are 120 students in class, you invent new techniques. Students write questions on pieces of paper, put them on the podium, and you answer those questions first thing in class. And that often gives you a lead in to something different. And also, some of Anderson's stories, I just taught three of them an hour ago, are small masterpieces. And that's always fun. When a work of art really is splendid, you can always talk about it endlessly. There are certain works of art that I'm finished with, you'll never do it again. There are others you can do again and again.
What are those?
Well, today I talked about the Nightingale. The Shadow is a very dark story, The Shadow Knows. And the story of Mother, the tragedy about losing a child.
Oh, you referenced that yesterday.
Yes.
The one that you were frightened of as
Precisely.
A child yourself.
And I told the students today, that's the first thing in class. And they take to that. I mean, comments like this, they take to it, they like. That they get to know me a little bit better, because I reveal this secret of my childhood.
Yes. Yeah. Which we all want, don't we?
Yes, sure.
From the authority,
yeah.
And in this case, you're the authority. Are you a real person?
Sure. Yeah. And that's why they come up afterwards and ask questions, of course. So that tricks the trades. That's a fun. That's what I think pedagogy is. These tricks to the trades.
Did you find the first year you taught Anderson that you enjoyed it more than you thought you would?
Yes, I did. Partly because I had a class of 60 and students came up with lots of questions. That helped an awful lot. Mm-hmm. So the first year was a lot of fun. And also, I mean, there were always wonderful moments in every class. But as the class grew, and I put a ceiling of 300, I think.
Oh, 300?
Yeah. Then it, you know, became a bit mechanical. Also because that's one of the curses for old teachers. It's fun to teach, but it's not so much fun to prepare. Prepare what you already know.
Yes.
And last night I was preparing these three stories, and I couldn't do it. I didn't have to because I know them so well. You have to think about them.
Yes. Yeah. Now, as the course got larger, what would you require of the students? Did they all have to write papers as well as take exams?
We had an option between, I think it was 2 and 3 credits or 3 or 4 credits. And the extra credits required a paper.
Mm-hmm.
Or an extra exam. The students had a choice there. Otherwise, they had 3 exams. And I had lots of readers, not TAs as such, but readers. And we always met in there, the dining room table, after each exam. And then we read answers, essay answers to each other. So we tried to grade the same way. Because otherwise you would have a hullabaloo in the classroom.
Yes, yeah. And everybody would come and complain to you about
exactly.
Their grade.
Exactly, which they should, of course. But that's also the way to educate them to be teachers, my assistants, of course. So it, and that also takes time. To instruct assistants,
yes.
Takes a lot of time.
Yeah. Yeah. So the first year you taught Anderson was 1980?
80, yeah.
And then did you go on to teach that every year?
Yes, I did. For a while. What happened one year was that there was a tremendous influx of freshmen, first-year students. So the message came down from the dean's office, I think, or the chancellor. We have to lift the ceilings. We have to make room for more students. So I said, okay, doesn't matter whether I teach 300 or 400, take the ceiling off. Then the bookstore called and said, we have a problem because your textbook, that's one textbook, is out of print. Which meant I had to find 4 books instead, 4 anthologies.
Oh, God.
And then they said, by the way, your enrollment is 880 students. What? I said. But, you know, what can you do? So I was teaching in the Bascom room, I think 160, in front of the chancellor's office. And there was this 800 students milling around out there. And so I had to stand on a chair and a microphone and tell them, go down to the humanities building, we'll meet down there. A very nice professor in English, Charles Bush.
Oh.
Yeah. Who later became dean, and my favorite dean, by the way. Had using 3660 in humanities, the big one.
Yes.
He was kind enough to give that to me. Move his class elsewhere. So I got that room, 500 students, and the other 300 something upstairs in 2660, where TA student emulated.
So you actually taught?
Yeah, I did. And that was not easy. Not because there were 800 students, but because I had, you know, 6, 7, 8 TAs. And not all of them were equally good. You had to hire TAs from other departments. And when your assistants are not up to par, you have problems. Of course you do. Yeah. Students realize there's a weak TA here who gives 2 good grades or 2 bad grades. So these problems, you know, surface, they have to be ironed out.
And how do you iron out that problem with TAs?
Well, if you bring them up here and you hammer in the truth, and you think it's the truth, what they have to do, what they can't do, which is not always. Now and then you have to fire some or ask them to resign, otherwise you have to go through a big legal thing with the university. So normally they understand that they have done something they shouldn't have done, and then they resign. Then you try to find somebody else, but normally, I mean, most of the TAs are fine, and they, when they realize that teacher has a problem, they step in and help you out and do extra grading and things like that. I mean, you become teams, you know. And they're very, very, and most of my TAs have been immensely valuable to me and help me out when we have problems.
Now, was the Anderson course 1 or 2 semesters?
1 semester.
1 semester. Did you teach it twice a year?
No, I didn't. But now and then I taught summer school. And I like summer school because classes are smaller. And I teach a 3-week session. So you have the rest of the summer anyway to go to Wyoming or Denmark, or both. And students are only taking your class, so they're well prepared. Instead of taking 5 classes, they take 1 class. Summer school can be wonderful.
Really?
So there, yeah. So there I could talk to about Anderson, you know, to 30 or 50 students. That's what sort of reinvigorated me about Anderson.
What did you learn about Anderson yourself that you had not known?
Well, yeah, and let me add a question I get quite often to that. Why is he alive today when so many contemporaries, other tellers of tales, are not alive?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's only a guess. But that's what I've said for years in classroom. People ask me a question, I can't answer it. I normally say, I have a hunch. When you read his yearly collection of tales, 4, 5, 6 tales, don't cohere. They don't agree. Tale contradicts tale. I don't think that Anderson ever found a philosophy, a worldview. He experimented. Now that he's Christian, now that he's atheist. I think the tales are an exploration of existence, trying to find, figure out the riddle for life. And this constant quest makes his language so alive. And the fact that the tales are sort of not really finished, having no closure at times, is moral. They're ambiguous. And in the beginning of the class, the students were very irritated. They wanted the real Hans Christian Andersen to stand up. And he never did. And I find that intriguing. That's all what kept me going with the class. So
I wish I had taken your course.
You'd be on DVDs.
I take it, since you were giving a lecture today, you don't still offer the course, do you?
No. I had a young man help me out. He was my reader first grader, then he became my TA. And then when we went video, he became my right-hand man. And when I retired, he took over the course and taught us, using videos in the classroom.
Oh.
When I retired in 2003, we allowed the video class to go on PBS, Wisconsin, until 2005, because Anderson turned 200. And then we pulled it out, because I should not replace myself with the video. So Scott uses the videos in the classroom now, and somebody else does too.
And you go in to make an occasional...
Well, Scott is in Holland right now, and so I've sat for him. But they call me in now and then to do my thing, yes, I do.
Do you enjoy that?
Yeah, sure, I do. It's nice to feel that you still do it.
Yes, sure. That's true. And what else are you teaching now during the 80s? Are you adding new courses?
Yeah, I'm teaching masterpieces, which I enjoy because you rush through Scandinavian literature from Middle Ages to 1900. It's kind of fun. And the fun there is partly that you get these students. I had towards the end about 250 students in that class.
Really?
Yeah. They're interested. And that is, I mean, can Dean say, we only had 3 students in 3rd year Danish, well, I had 250 masterpieces. You don't get complaints anymore at low courses. You don't, really. We had these big movements. And that I teach, and I enjoy that because I realize the students come there and have very little background. They don't know your history or Western history. they barely know what the Renaissance is. Luther and Reformation, what was that? It's very important to have this general cultural background. So I have a co-published issue, Brantley, which is the moral stuff. We do intellectual history as background, and then the works on top of that. And students take to it. They do. So it works out. Since the very, my very first year in 65, I taught Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher. And that has grown on me too over the years. And it's interesting, in our classes, students ask. We always have more students that sign up. And Kierkegaard is different because he scares people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I asked students I knew very well, why did you drop my class? And the answer was, I'm scared of Kierkegaard. And I said, you should be. He's essentially very, 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 very tough. And that's all he says, I have to reintroduce Christianity into Christendom, because I know who Christians are. One of those toughens. And that course I enjoyed from the very beginning to the very end.
Now, is that course cross-listed with philosophy?
No, but with what you call religious studies, the religious studies program. No, because this is a literary approach. I take a literary approach.
Oh, I see.
Kierkegaard is an experimental novelist. And I add other authors who are inspired by Kierkegaard or react to Kierkegaard, against Kierkegaard.
Now, you've taught here since 1965, so really 40 years almost, give or take, you're
yeah,
in
yeah.
the classroom. How has the UW undergraduate student body changed for better and for worse?
In the beginning, I think I was lucky because the students who came to Scandinavian Studies really wanted to be Scandinavian Studies. But then Scandinavian Studies changed and got these big service courses. At one point, we said to ourselves, sitting in the faculty meeting, why should English and French have all these sophomore classes? Why shouldn't we have them too? And that's how we did the masterpieces at Anderson. And it worked. So now it gets different students. Students who just need three more credits in the humanities, in literature, sophomore less. Some friends took the class, I would take it too. Well, I got an A last year, so I would take it this year. So you get students who are not really all that interested. Mm-hmm. And of course you can feel that. You also notice that in classes like Kierkegaard, which people take who really want to take it, you get very good teaching motivations. In these big classes, they're poor, because you give all bad grades. You know, you give people, you have to use the whole scale. I tell students that you get what you deserve. You don't use the curve. So that you get it. So, I mean, that influences the evaluations, of course. Because in Kierkegaard, nearly everybody does well because they want to be there and study very hard. So then you get the indifferent students in these service classes. The students who probably should not be here. The people who may bail out after 1 year. The pass-fail students who just pass. So, and I have to say that my TAs, my readers, who are good students, often first-year grad students, whatnot, they are flabbergasted when they read these essays. They can't grasp that these students have such poor English ability to write in English. Poor grammar, limited vocabulary, misspellings galore, poor syntax, and they can't express themselves. I didn't have that the first 5-6 years until we got these research experiences. So I'm not sure that the quality has gone down because, I mean, supposedly we only get the best of the best for high schoolers. But impressed I'm not. Mm-hmm. And my TAs are not either. But that's something, that's a problem here, which I bring up in both Anderson and Masterpieces. I had the first exam after 5 weeks to get people out that shouldn't be there. And everybody should see what kind of exams we give. That's fair play. It's always the exams, never a multiple choice or anything like that. It's always a choice. And when I had the back exams, I usually for an hour to explain what people did wrong and what was right. Actually, he needed this then.
Not bad.
I said, well, something that happens is this. I talk to a person who got a C minus or a D in my office, because a person wants to know why, and I understand that. I'm willing to talk to any of you during my office hours. And that student expresses himself or herself very well and seems to speak in English that makes sense, and a beautiful English. Why then can't you write that one? Well, I said, go back to your high school and talk to your English teacher and ask why. I really think the high schools are to blame for much of the misery they experience at the universities.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to other colleagues at other universities, and they tend to agree.
Mm-hmm.
So since our job here to teach remedial English.
No. Let me refocus the interview now and ask you to evaluate the strengths and weaknesses of the department and how it has grown and changed over your 40 years
in
the department.
I have quite often been asked to evaluate other Scandinavian programs and departments in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Seattle, Berkeley, UCLA, Minnesota, and St. Olaf and a few other places, plus some departments in at this university. And I must say that I have felt over the years that the department at UW has been doing very well.
Oh.
There are, of course, the quality fluctuates a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Every time somebody goes on leave, there's a gap. And we are not always allowed to fill that gap. Which means that there are too few classes for the students, and the students feel that very strongly. Also, the problem is that you cannot always give enough seminars. Graduate students need seminars. And one graduate student once says, whenever a seminar is given, no matter what, take it. So there are these gaps. And that is problematic in terms of the education we can offer our graduate students. Also, since we have these big service classes for undergraduates, we tend to pour a lot of energy into those. Once again, the graduate students at times feel a bit neglected.
Hmm.
Well, we give them independent reading, which is very important and very, very, very stimulating for student and teacher alike. But how many can you have of those during the semester? If you have three of those and have to prepare, you don't have time to write that article.
Mm-hmm.
So there are problems there, and they are problems that remain there, I'm afraid.
Mm.
Typical small department problem. Now, my colleagues, I appreciate very much.
Mm-hmm.
I've done so for many, many years. I mean, Dick Ringler in English, as Scandinavian Studies, our Old Norse teacher, Kim Nilsson, the philologist, the linguist, Harald Ness, the Norwegian, Sue Brantley, who was added in the 80s in Swedish, are wonderful colleagues.
Hmm.
And they're good teachers, they listen to students, and even though we disagree quite often about issues, that is sort of debated out in the faculty meeting. And afterwards we get along fine.
Generally a congenial department?
Yes, a congenial department is. Since we have big classes, a lot hinges on TAs, also because they tend to handle some language classes. And frankly, there the quality goes up and down. One year the teaching of, say, just an example, first year Swedish might be brilliant, the next year exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have some lecturers who's hired from the outside, sort of between the professors and the TAs. They're there for two or three years at a time. They're not on tenure track. They are often ABDs from other campuses, or they are people who are hired from the Scandinavian countries. And now and then they are wonderful colleagues, really a part of the team, and now and then they simply don't fit in because they don't understand the American system or our system. Mm-hmm. But again, these are problems that haunt small programs, and there's problems that cannot really be resolved. Yes, for the time being, but then they pop up again.
Is the Scandinavian department, studies department at UW, one of the best in America?
Oh yeah, I think our competition is Berkeley.
So you battle with Berkeley for the top ranking?
Yeah, I think so. Is Washington is fine too, and Minnesota. Well, Minnesota had the sad fate that Scandinavian studies, the department, was merged with German and Dutch. About 10 years ago, yes.
Which
is not a good sign.
No.
Then there are some very good programs at UCLA and Illinois. And I was thinking about Yale, but that doesn't exist any longer. But Berkeley, Wisconsin, that's a toss-up to me. And then Washington, then I assume Minnesota. I rather send, I think, people to UCLA than to Minnesota and Seattle.
When I think about students enrolling in Scandinavian studies, have you seen an increase or decrease in majors?
Definitely increase. Right now we have a very active Danish lecturer who is, by the way, is now on Rolling Horizon, a very nice move. She was sent out by Denmark and paid for mainly by Denmark. Denmark does that. They send young people out for 3 or 6 years. And she came for 6 years and liked it here, and her husband is an American and wanted to stay here, and somehow it was worked out after I retired that she could stay on as a Rolling Horizon. And she is very active directing our life and our cultural studies course. And she has also seemed sort of gotten a lot of students into the department as majors. So the number of majors has grown. And also the number of graduate students, I think, is nearly too big.
Really?
Yes, because what should we do with them? I mean, if they want a master's in English studies for the sake of interest, fine. If they want to get a PhD and teach, well, where are the jobs? There are not that many. I know that a number of people want my job, and only one person can get it.
Yes.
And you may not be so happy if you become the Norwegian professor at a small Lutheran college somewhere. Mm-hmm. And you are the only Scandinavianist, or maybe one or two. You know, it's not the same milieu or atmosphere as we have it here.
Do a fair number of your graduates go on to careers in the diplomatic?
No, not really. Funny things do happen. I mean, one was hired because he knew Swedish. He was hired by American unions.
Really?
So funny things like that happen. One person now owns a sort of RC Crafty store in Madison, Orange Tree Imports.
Oh, Orange Schroeder?
Yeah, sure. Someone into foundation works. Actually, one or two got jobs abroad, one in Norway, one in Holland, I think. But most of them are heading for professorships in the States or Canada.
Mm-hmm. This concludes side 2 of tape 3. This is tape number 4, side 1 of the ongoing oral history interview with Emeritus Professor of Scandinavian Studies, Niels Ingerson, November 1st, 2006. As we're talking about where your graduates have gone, I'm reminded of Tom Loftus, former Speaker of the State Assembly in the state of Wisconsin, and then I think Ambassador to Norway during the Clinton administration. Did you all have a relationship with him?
Well, we both of us sort of knew him, shook hands with him. And as I recall, when he got that position in Norway, he called the chair, wherever that was at the time, and asked the chair to find a person who could perfect his Norwegian. How much he knew, I don't know. So we found a young woman who dealt with Tom Loftus, and we talked to Tom Loftus for quite a while, I think. So I think Mr. Loftus was quite well prepared to go to Norway when he finally left.
A point in his favor that he wanted to learn Norwegian.
Absolutely. We were all sorry he didn't become governor.
Yes, I'm sure. Also, let me ask you, we were just talking on break, about the relations of the department and perhaps you individually with the Norwegian community in Stoughton, the Danish community in Racine. What kind of relationship, if any, there is?
Well, I'm lucky I'm a Dane. There are fewer Danes in USA than Norwegians and the Swedes. And the Danes scatter, while the Norwegians and Swedes form societies. So if you are a Norwegian and a Swede, you have to go and talk to these clubs or societies most of the time.
Okay.
But now and then they catch me too. And I have been to Stoughton to tell stories. I was sandwiched in between the canoe race and lunch. So very few people listen to my stories. But, you know, for instance, the libraries out here once got a grant from NEH called Not for Children Only. And I was out talking to 6, 7, 8 libraries in small towns, Stoughton, Jefferson, whatever they were called, small cities out there, for a group of sort of 20 to 30 people. I talked about folklore and Hans Christian Andersen. That worked very well.
Mm-hmm.
So I have given the number of, over the years, number of talks, probably 3, 4, 5, 6 per year to various groups of citizens who have Scandinavian connections. We all do that. That's part of the service.
Uh-huh.
And they normally pay our gasoline, and that's about it. And that's fine.
This is just a personal curiosity. While I'm sure that there was not a huge Danish migration to the United States during the 19th century, where did the Danes go? Was it primarily to Wisconsin?
No. They went to England. And then they went to Nebraska. There's a book called Take All to Nebraska about Danes in Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And they also on the West Coast, they are pretty strong in the Seattle area. And when I taught at UCLA, I went to the Danish church in Los Angeles, which was in a black neighborhood, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And some went to Florida and tried to start a utopian community. It didn't work. So the Danes are sort of all over, but there are very few Danish towns, strong Danish communities, unlike the Swedish and Norwegian.
And was there as high a percentage of Danes leaving as there were Norwegians and Swedes?
No, more Norwegians, more Swedes. I can't remember the numbers here, but fewer Danes.
Uh-huh.
And the reason is, of course, that Denmark doesn't have any rocks. Any mountains. We have fertile agricultural land. In Norway, you know, what is it, 4% of the land is arable.
I know it's not much.
They had to leave. I mean, the younger sons, there was no land for them. And Denmark is much more citified. And many of the Danes who come, you know, were not farmers as such. They were, carpenters and whatever. I mean, they settled down in the big cities, Chicago, New York, whatever. Many fewer Danish farmers, as such.
Interesting. Niels, as you have made reference to the existence of small departments in the college, maybe this is a good time for you to talk about the relationship of the department with then dean of the college, David Cronin, in the early 1980s.
Well, yes. The chair always sees the dean there so often.
Mm-hmm.
And you bring your request to the dean, and now and then they okay your request, and now and then they don't. And that's their job. That's highly understandable. And I have to say that your life at the university is much, much easier when you have a dean who is fair.
And now then you, of course, have the feeling that the deal is not fair, and that the, it might be you who is unfair here, who isn't fair. But, you know, subjective opinions here catch. In 1980, I knew some people from the department of comparative literature pretty well, the younger people there. And I thought that the department had made some excellent hires. Comparatists had to know a lot about theory, methodology, and you know what? New ideas. And I felt that these young people did that. One of these young people was Professor John Brinkman. I didn't know him well, but I knew his students, and they certainly felt that he was a fine teacher and scholar. And he had at that point been here for actually 6 years and was going up for tenure in April. And the department voted on him, and the vote was 9-4 him, 3 against him. There was one abstention and one secular abstention. I mean, okay, that shows there was some problem because 3 were against him. To this I should add a preface or a footnote. The Department of Conflict had had severe problems because the senior faculty could not get along. They feuded, which meant that the young people were in trouble. They had to choose sides. And that's very, very difficult. To sit on the fence did not vote either. So a committee had come in, so-called Fowler Committee, and written a very strong criticism of the department and pointed out that in the future the deans ought to protect the untenured faculty against the older faculty. And in order to remedy matters, the dean, and I agreed with the dean completely, they are moved 5 faculty members outside the department, into the department, to be overseers. So the department was no longer running itself. They had an outside chair, Dean Mulvihill. Okay. So things were always tense and coupled, and we all knew that. Common knowledge. And I think the dean called it the right thing, because if the department cannot run its own business, you have to have overseers. I mean, respected members rather than departments. They voted and decided to send the case up to the Division of Committee for the Humanities. And let me quote here. Dean Mulvihill, who was chair of Conflict, wrote, he was in Spanish actually, but he's now chair of Conflict. In sum, Professor Brinkman has been a vigorous and effective member of the Comparative Literature Department, as well as a supporting contributor to the various activities of other departments, as several supporting letters indicate. The quality of his performance as teacher and scholar has received the highest commendation of both local faculty and nationally known respected figures in his field. The scope of his interests and flexibility of his talents will greatly increase the breadth and vigor of the program compared to virtual in Wisconsin. April 17th, this was written or dated March 3rd, April 17th. The Humanities Division Committee recommended my promotion and tenure, as Frank writes this. Their decision was unanimous, with 2 members not participating. So they are unanimous, which speaks very loudly. May 3rd, and this is Frank writing again. Professor Mulvihill informed me that he had, quote, just received a letter from Dean Croner indicating that, after careful review, he has decided not to recommend you for promotion and tenure, unquote. And that my appointment was terminated as at the end of the 1980-81 academic year. May 15. At my request, Brinkman's, Dean Croner provided a statement of reasons for his decision. Quote, my position, unquote, he begins, quote, involves important issues of program and budget rather than your professional qualifications. The letter the copy of which can be comprised, general interest, goes on and so on, so forth. So it's not his qualifications, his merits. It's a matter of program and budget. Program means that his company is sick. Do not have another position. And budget means we are receiving a 1% budget cut, so we shouldn't give another person tenure because that involves $1 million. There you have the issue in a nutshell.
So Dean Cronin was trying to send a message to Complet by denying tenure for Brinkman?
It seemed so. I mean, don't expect more from me, but another person had just gotten tenure in Complet. And everybody else who had been set up by other departments to the division committee had gotten tenure. So Brinkman is the only one who got to get it, as I recall. I have to point out that Cronin then ends his letter by pointing out he had the right to appeal. So a process has now started. Let me see what's in this. This is Cronin writing again about this, why he did this. This is David May 15. My position involves important issues of program and budget, rather than your professional qualifications. Specifically, in recent weeks, a variety of considerations has brought me to the conclusion that it's not wise at this time for the college to increase the tenure density and thereby its financial commitment to the Department of Comparative Literature. So the department, you're right, has been singled out. And again, you know, it's not your merits. You're probably qualified, but we can't give you tenure anymore. This angered a lot of people in the humanities. And the committee got together consisting of people from German theology.
Really?
Yeah, French, political science, Scandinavian studies, philosophy. Scandinavian and philosophy. There was eight people. And we composed this letter and read to you about 10 lines of it. But dated October 8, 80. Dear Professor Myers, that's Madison Governance Study Committee, the appealing, so about the head of the dean.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Dear Professor Myers, the undersigned members of the faculty are deeply concerned with the erosion of faculty governance at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. In our opinion, the recent decision on the part of the Dean of Letters of Science not to grant tenure to Assistant Professor John Brinkman in the Department of Complet is further evidence of such erosion. Mr. Brinkman was denied tenure in spite of his having been recommended for promotion by both the executive committee of his department and the division committee. In addition, the dean's decision is clearly adverse to the recommendations of the Comparative Lit Review Committee. In a report dated July 12, 1977, of the Fowler Committee, the committee stated that, above all, it was concerned with the unfortunate treatment of junior faculty in the department and advocated that steps be taken that would guarantee that junior faculty would not be denied or awarded tenure. That would guarantee that junior faculty would be denied or awarded tenure on merit only counts. For a dean to ignore the advice of a faculty committee, be it elected or appointed, is to undermine the concept of faculty government. Then later on, and I don't have a date here. Dean Cronin writes the following. I think at this point the case has been appealed to faculty to rights and responsibilities, that committee. And there were hearings there. And there were open hearings, so I went quite often. Brinkman at that point was represented by a lawyer. And supported by United Faculty, who was back with him, and I think that United Faculty got funding through AFT, the teachers' union. Cronin writes, In my 27 years as a faculty member at this and other universities, I have always understood that in reviewing personnel recommendations, including tenure recommendations, the dean has the responsibility to consider not only the candidate's professional qualifications and record, but also the effect of the appointment of tenure decision on budgetary limitations and program balance within the particular department and across the entire college. Indeed, if the dean does not take these latter factors into consideration, who will? And in theory, I agree. In principle, we all agree to that. Mm-hmm. That this rejection of faculty governance was too harsh for us to take. Mm-hmm. But there was no common ground. It's enough. Yeah, now we are with faculty rights and responsibilities, and we've lost a lot of words.
Finally,
well, later after a little bit out, you know, and there were people deciding on. Here's 150 faculty members from humanities and
social
science deciding. So people sort of came to Brinkman's aid.
150, that's quite a significant
number. Yeah, more
came
later. So singular people signed the documents individually. My case is 180 or something like this. And the case was making sort of people noticing all over the country. I got a number of phone calls. What's going on with you guys? This is the case now is with the faculty rights and responsibilities. And now I'm beginning to lose touch with the case because I'm getting my offer from UCLA. And also we have done more than we could do, getting all these signatures together and listening to the rights and responsibilities and so on. And my guess is that it's all in sense, I feel that we've won all the battles and lost the war. If Curran did not budge, here's the second to last statement I read to you. This is to the faculty of the College of Arts and Science from an expanded committee. We were 8 people on this committee, and I was co-chair of this committee.
Uh-huh.
And now it's expanded to many, many people who later on became deans. Henry Lemoyne, Robert Sloot, who became vice chancellor.
Uh-huh.
So people later on moved into the administration were on our side in this battle here. It's always fun to see them again at picnics or whatnot.
We write, just one paragraph here. The Committee on Faculty Rights and Responsibilities overturned the dean's original decision and mandates a reconsideration because the errors in Cromer's decision were found to be such that Professor Brinkman has suffered material prejudice, unquote, resulting in, quote, harm, unquote, and, quote, damage, unquote. So they agreed with us up to a point. But my guess is that they cannot tell the dean what to do. Because, I mean, dean has the right to make decisions. And he only has to listen to advice. He doesn't have to follow.
He has to do what the chancellor tells him to do.
Well, then another committee was formed. I was not a member of that because I shouldn't be on the committee.
Mm-hmm.
But Harlan Ness was on that, my colleague.
Uh-huh.
And Iron Soul was on the committee and other people. And they went to shame. And reiterated the whole thing. Now we're back in 82. Now we're up to 82. And Brinkman got another year here. That was one minor victory. But Shane agreed to Cromer. But apparently, the rings in the water have spread, and Brinkman was offered a job at Northwestern University.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I think it was either tenure track or tenure right away. So it ended well. But it was, you know, a big uphill. It took a year of my life, actually. And I have to read one last thing to you here. It's this letter I just quoted from. It's long. And it went out to all members of Letters and Science. And it ends like this. In summary, we, this big familiar thing, and if you sign here, you have to agree with that opinion. In summary, we regret in Cronin's decision to deny tenure of John Brinkman. The Dean's action challenges the integrity of peer review and the future of faculty governance. Material prejudice resulting in damage or harm has only been compounded by the procedural irregularities and the manner in which so much unfounded, undocumented opinion was presented by the Dean to the 900 members of the late of the LS faculty. There was a lot of rumors flying around.
Mm-hmm.
We always are in the having cases. Last paragraph. If you wish to add your name to this statement and join us in your effort to repair the injustice done to Professor Brinkman, please sign below and return this portion of our statement to Professor Nils Ingels in Scandinavian Studies, 1302 Red House. So
you really were one of the key leaders in this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was, and I talked endlessly to people, and people talked endlessly to me, and were very wrangled and upset. We did not deny the Dean the right to make these decisions, but we thought we definitely made the very wrong decision.
And did this damage your long-term relationship with Dave Cronin?
Well, I always said afterwards, I won't be chair again until we have another thing. Didn't quite work out because then I became director of folklore and overlapped with Cronin's tenure. So I saw him again in the office as the official. We were very polite to each other. The good thing about this place is you're not really scared about ramifications or revenge, to use a nasty term. In our department, the chair decides about merit increases on his own. And then walks around and shows everybody what he or she has decided without showing that person what he gets or she gets. So you all get to see what the others get and then you can agree or disagree.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
And then this recommendation goes to the Dean's office. And as far as I know, the Dean has never said in any department, this person is getting too much.
Oh, really? There is respect.
There is respect, yes. There is faculty governance there. And the department had a lot of self-governance there, but autonomy. Now then the Dean would say, well, we have an extra lump of money, you know, you can give it to one of these people, two, three, as happened to me a few times, as chair.
Mm-hmm.
Then you find somebody who's very deserving, and you give the money to that person, or screw it up, or whatever. So I don't think there was any punishment as such. But who knows?
How was it that you got so involved with the Brinkman case? Was that as much a philosophical commitment to faculty governance, or was it because of your own intellectual interest in comparative literature?
I go to a yearly conference called SAS, Scandinavian Society for the Advancement of Scandinavian Study. They meet every year somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and we all fly out there to do papers and to see the others,
mm-hmm.
and meet old friends and former students. It's very festive. Ends with a banquet and dance. We started that here in Madison.
Oh, really?
In 1970, sure. And when you sit there late night and have a drink or two, you hear about how colleagues are treated, other departments are treated. I always felt that this was a wonderful place to be. With a lot of integrity, a lot of faculty governance, a lot of departmental autonomy, and actually a fair deal with the deans. So I was very surprised when this happened. And some of my students were taking Brinkman's classes, and they came and talked to me. We had five students in common. And when these were very bright young people, And when they were upset, I understood why they were upset. So I talked to some friends in other departments. At this point, I know so many people, you know. In Van Hees, you meet people all the time, going with those elevators up and down.
Yeah.
So the word spread, it was like wildfire in Van Hees.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to get together one night, six or eight of us, and talk about this. We got some philosophy and German and whatnot. And we decided to form this ad hoc committee and do something about it. And that's how the snowball started rolling.
Mm-hmm. Dave Cronin seems to have been a very powerful dean.
Yes.
His name comes up repeatedly in interviews, pro and con.
Oh, yes.
But for better or for ill, he seems to have been a dominant influence in the college.
He was, and was dean for many years. Deans tend to step down earlier, and he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
He was there for a long, long time. And I went to his goodbye party, big dance in the Great Hall in the Union. We decided, well, we'll go to it anyway and have a good time. And we did. And we did.
That's good. It's also during this time period that you're in touch with UCLA, are you not?
I am, because a former student of mine got a PhD and got a job at UCLA. And I saw her there at a conference, and she came here and was a visitor quite often. And at this point, I tell her, we talk often over the phone, that I'm a bit burned out because the Brinkman case had disappointed me and taken a lot of my time away from what I should be doing, teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Teaching often got short shrift during those years, during that year. She said, why don't you come to UCLA for a year? We have a professor who is going to go to Sweden, and you can probably find an opening for you. Okay, I said, try.
Uh-huh.
So she came back and said, listen, we have an opening for a year. I said, I don't want a year, because I'm sure you like LA. I've never been there. And what about 2 quarters happy? Finally, she said, but we have to give you a better salary than you get in Wisconsin, because Wisconsin is cheap. LA is not. So I got a wonderful raise for that half a year. And told my colleagues, I hope you'll let me leave. Because it's ticklish. Will I be replaced?
Yes.
And I wasn't.
Oh.
So there you have one of the problems.
They had to pick up your load.
Yes. So there's some of the courses that are not taught, and especially for the graduate students, it really is a problem. Your advisor leaves. Somebody else has to step in. So you have to think about the program, the department, but somehow it worked out. And also, I was only going for a semester, the spring semester. So we loaded up the car, took the cat on the back seats, and drove for a week to LA. It was a fun drive through America. I saw states I'd never seen before, New Mexico, Arizona.
And you'd never been in Los Angeles before?
No, I've been to Santa Barbara, but Berkeley, but they also in LA, and that was kind of scary driving there.
I'll bet.
Yeah. And my friend there, Mary Kane, also, who just got married, I just saw her get married 2 days ago, had gotten us a wonderful summer cabin in Venice Beach.
Oh, nice.
Which then was a hippie colony. Got a house, you know, 3 houses from the boardwalk, basically from the beach. And there we were installed with our cat. And I admit it cost a lot, so I'm glad I got that raise. And this was the 8th of January, 82. And I was sitting there preparing classes for the next day, just probably about a little time. And I realized, outside it is snowing. 8th of January, I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. I kept my Madison mindset. Of course it was 80 degrees outside. So then I started teaching UCLA, which was a wonderful experience because nobody knew me. I had small classes. I didn't have to read the faculty mail or go to meetings, just teach. And I taught a graduate class and undergraduate class. And it was fun to drive a Sunset Boulevard to UCLA in the morning after rush hour at Santa Monica Freeway and then find your own little surface road back to during rush hour at by the Calvary Arsenal.
Were the undergraduates better than at Wisconsin?
Again, these were people who picked up Scandinavian studies, wanted to be in that class.
Wanted to be.
Yeah. So they were fine. They were fine. So it's sort of semi-vacation, which I actually needed.
Yeah.
But out there, I could start going again on writing, and that I enjoyed very, very much. And then it was fun to walk along the boardwalk, along the beach to the bank and the grocery store. I go out to the desert, look at flowers.
This is side two of tape four, Niels Ingerson. You're in California.
I'm in California and having a very good time. Also, this was a time when people really started inviting me to do guest lectures elsewhere. So I went to University of Washington and gave a lecture or two up there, and as I recall, I stopped with Gene Oregon on the way back. So it was a sort of traveling vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Really, with Mary Kay Olsen, we went up to a colleague who had a job at Michigan, who then decided, I don't want to be a star, I want to make wine instead. So he had a vineyard up the coast. We went there to taste this wonderful wine. And then with some friends, we went down to Baja, Mexico, where the water is so warm you can swim down there. At UCLA, the water is too cold.
Yes. Yeah. Were you at all tempted to think about trying to get an appointment at UCLA?
We flirted. And it was, California is amazing. I mean, here it is, sensual country, beautiful flowers all year round. To walk along the beach is great. There's wonderful theater and museums and whatnot. It was solid temptation. I'm not sure it ever would materialize because I'm not sure they want to expand the Scandinavian program out there. The person I replaced was coming back, next fall. But the thought was there. But then also, I had a few behind in Wisconsin, and even though I was a bit tired of things, I still liked the apartment very, very much.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I got involved with football. And that also